time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at wjcu.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at outspokencyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for January 30th, 2021. Where did the month go? Before we get to our show this week, I'd like to make a correction from my blog entry for Bike Bentonville from last week. I said that Dirty Kanza had been changed to the Big Sugar Ride. Nope, incorrect, not even close. In fact, Big Sugar is a new ride, which is sold out, by the way. And Dirty Kanza's new name is Unbound. Both are lifetime events. Many apologies for my faux pas, and I promise to try not to do that again. So moving right along, I think our show this week is pretty interesting. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Shimano announced that it would take over neutral support for the Peloton at the 2021 Tour de France. Many of you know that neutral support has been the purview of Mavic, with their yellow support vehicles loaded with bikes and wheels and equipment and people and food. But today we learn more about neutral support from Chris Sigmund, who was not only part of it, but knows the history very well. We'll have our fourth and final installment of our training tips with Coach Chris Carmichael. Today, we discuss weekly mileage, whether you should take one long ride a week or break it up into several short rides. And finally, we'll speak with a trio of folks from Northeast Ohio who are working to bring 30 miles of new paths between the west side and the east side of the Cleveland Lakefront in an effort to finally do what needs to be done in developing our North Shore. So my first guest, Chris Sigmund, has been in the bicycle world since the 1980s. He started out stealing his older brother's bike, subsequently wrecked it, and found out that the bicycle would be a lifelong passion. From working at a local bike shop in New Hampshire to a stint with Specialized at the beginning of his career, Chris has been all over the world, involved in the deepest levels of the sport. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's been a really long time since we caught up.
It has. Thank you for having me. It's been sort of fun keeping in touch on social media, but this is always better.
It is. It is. And the last time we spoke, you're going to laugh, maybe, we were talking about Urban Press Camp. That was in 2012.
Yes, that's an event I miss dearly and had so much fun, bringing everybody to, and love to do that again. But yeah, I can't believe it's been that long.
It has been. And I noticed somebody brought it up the other day, which is how we sort of reconnected for this conversation. They were talking about the Swedish embassy, and I said it was the pottery that I liked so much.
Yeah.
It was such a cool place.
Amazing. Yeah, how amazing was that place?
It was. I remember what it was. It was a picture of the screen with Bill McKibben on it.
Right.
And out of that, I got to talk with Bill McKibben. He was one of my very first guests because my show started in 2010. But out of Urban Press Camp, that was one of my first guests, was Bill McKibben.
Yeah, he was so generous to join us. And even to this day, he remains, despite his infamy, he remains relatively accessible. So he's what a great champion.
He is a cool guy. Well, let's talk about you. So I have a lot of new listeners since the last time we spoke, and I'd like to let them know who you are. So if you would just kind of back up and tell us a little bit about your background and your work in the bicycle world and how it sort of became your life's work. Bicycle gene. We call that having the bicycle gene.
The bicycle gene, exactly. Well, it's sort of funny. Probably two events in my life, in my youth, sort of surfaced that gene, I guess I'd say. I was the younger of two brothers. And of course, if you're a younger, Everything your older sibling does or gets is the bee's knees, right? You've just got to have it. It's better than what you have and all that. Well, I was a youngster in the 70s bike boom, and my older brother, Greg, got this Italian racing bike. It's a brand we don't ever see. In fact, it was probably just a bike boom bike. The brand was Fleet Wing. It was made in Italy out of some straight gauge Columbus tubing, but it had Campagnolo Valentino components on it, and I was smitten. And like all younger brothers, I borrowed it without permission. It was, of course, way too big for me. I subsequently smashed it up, and I was in big trouble. And I had to not only earn money to pay for its repair, but also I volunteered to fix as many things as I could. And I discovered that I really liked tinkering with bicycles. And that kind of got me started. And when I was a little bit older, I got my own first, you know, air quotes, English racer. I got a Moto Bacan. And I really started becoming aware of heroes like young Greg LeMond winning junior world championships. And you might remember a fellow by the name of Lon Haldeman, one of the guys who raced across America.
Oh, yeah.
Or George Mount was an early, I was an early fan. So I kind of, you know, in my preteen and young teen years, got that sort of bubbling. And the other sort of event or non-event was the fact that I was simply a terrible student. I was super distracted in high school, probably ADD, but we didn't really call it that then. I was just tinkering with and thinking about bikes a lot. I started fixing other friends' bikes and probably ruining them, but I thought I was fixing them anyway. I really had the bug. The only thing I was doing pretty well at school with was music. So in my mind, all the way through high school, I was getting completely average grades academically, but I just thought, well, yeah, I'm sure I'll go into music or something like that. Now, I come to find out that's as rigorous as anything else, maybe more so, to get into any sort of music school, and I flunked out. I couldn't get a start in that. So I got a job at a couple of the local area bike shops and to just kind of think about what to do with my future. And it was my start at legendary Bloomfield Bike Shop in Bloomfield, Connecticut, that really I discovered a couple of skills that I had, some natural gifts of selling and fixing bikes. That's what got it started.
And that is so interesting. I sort of needed a job. I was a single mom with a two-year-old and knew somebody who owned a bike shop. And that's how I got into it. Who would have thought that would be a career, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think we all thought it was a temporary stop along the way, but here it is. I don't know how many years later, I'm still here. So,
let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Chris Zygmunt. He is jack of all trades in the bicycle business. We're going to talk about some of the things he's done over the years, one of which is something we've been talking about, neutral support. But we'll get to that. Because we had a question on our Facebook page about neutral support, and you are the perfect person to talk about that. So talk about some of the projects after working at the bike shop that have led you to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. I laugh sometimes and sort of say I'm sort of a Forrest Gump of the bicycle industry. that I, you know, not by any of my doing, but happen to be in a lot of the right places at the right times for some big happenings. When I was working at that shop in Connecticut, I was dating a really bright young lady who wanted to move to California to be with some of her friends in the worst way possible. And I'm like, we got to stay here and get back in the university and just finish things up. It's like, no, I'm going to California. You're either coming or you're going, you're whatever, I'm going anyway. And I said, okay, I'll go. Well, of course, we went out there. We had no jobs or anything. Well, I bugged this poor fellow at Specialized Bicycle Components, I think about 30 to 34 days in a row, nonstop phone calling. He basically just hired me, so I'd stop calling. So I started working at Specialized in 1985, just before my 21st birthday. And there was, a handful of people there. My then girlfriend was babysitting Mike Sinyard's two young toddlers. And it's when the Stump Jumper was really just becoming a commercial success, and mountain bikes were, there were only a handful of them out there that weren't custom Richies or Fishers.
Right.
And so it was kind of just blowing up then, and I got deeply involved in that. The other thing that happened in that experience was there was a gentleman by the name of Bill Woodall who was running the Specialized neutral race support. Specialized with the official neutral service of the Course Classic and many, many other races back then. And I got my first taste of neutral service then and pro racing. And I was that's it. I was hooked. I'd never had that, you know, all those heroes that I had seen in the pages of Winning or the paper edition of Velo News back then, I was seeing live and in person, and it changed my life. So, well,
yeah. So Velo News in those days was printed in Brattleboro, Vermont. So it was near correct. Where you kind of grew up. And it was that's what you had to read if you were into bike racing. Wow. So you got into neutral support that early. That is so cool. I had no idea.
Well, no, yeah. It's and Bill Whittle was really the godfather of it in North America anyway. And for many, many years. In fact, the USA Cycling Neutral Mechanics Clinic, still called the Bill Whittle, it's named in memoriam for Bill, who passed away a few years ago. And we teach a lot of the principles that he developed, which is great.
I had no idea.
Yeah, in fact, there's some great pictures. There's a Bill Whittle fan club on Facebook, and you know, you wouldn't do it today, but he had a full-on, full-size, I think I had a couple different versions of it, a Ford van or Dodge van, and he took this massive bubble skylight and cut out the roof so he could actually stand up inside and see the race going on through this big, you know, he used to do neutral service out of a van, a full-size van. It was crazy.
That seems to ring a bell for me, that stand, like I'd seen a picture somewhere of that van with somebody standing up through the roof, something in my old brain.
Right. It seems bizarre by today's standards, but yeah, it was de rigueur back then.
Right. And then, so how did you move on eventually to things like press camp and some of the other working for SRAM? You've done some really cool things.
Yeah, that specialized opportunity opened up some doors. Obviously, I became a sales rep. One of the brands I picked up back then was a brand called Mount Smith. They, at that point, were handmade backpacks out of Golden, Colorado, and I started doing their sales and marketing. I got hired away from them at the Mountain Bike World Cup in Vail. I met some French guys who said they worked for this company called Mavic, and they were looking for a marketing director. So I spent about 10 years as the U.S. marketing director for Mavic and ran their neutral service program for a long time. That brought me to, you know, everything from the Olympics for neutral service to, you know, I've done the Tour de France, some of the classics, Paris-Roubaix, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and pretty much any race in North America of note. And from that, I got hired away to work at a little company called Pedro's. That was is a bike tool and care manufacturer. They're owned by the ski giant Swix at that time.
Right.
And then our mutual friend, Lance Kamisaska, rang me up and had this crazy idea for something we doodled out. In fact, I still have the beer coaster. We doodled out an idea some years ago at a cross race I was still at Mavic, and had this idea like, what if we had a turnkey event where small brands that can't really attract the media just show up with their story and we arrange everything. We'll bring in the media, we'll arrange the rides, arrange the meals, and we launch press camp. And that was great. I did that for, I think, 5 years or so. And the nice people at SRAM attended and hired me away from there. So I became SRAM's global brand director for road product. And then that ended just 2 years ago. And I have been working with Global Cycling Network. People know GCN from YouTube and all that. And I work for their parent company doing some consulting and production work for them.
Wow. What a storied career. That is so cool. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Chris some more. I want to know more about neutral support. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I am speaking with Chris Zygmunt. He has such an amazing career with the bicycle industry, going all the way back to 1985 with Specialized, and then he worked with the neutral support for Coors, and then it's USA Cycling stuff, and Mountain Smith. I remember Mountain Smith, Mavic, which is where we're going to go in a moment, Pedro's. I remember them, and Lance, of course. I mean, Lance is doing the big gear show now.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's coming up. And then SRAM and Global Cycling Network. So you sort of went from paper to internet.
Exactly right.
Like all of us. So I want to talk about this neutral support thing. Neutral support, as far as I can remember in Europe, was always Mavic or Mavic. A couple of weeks ago, Shimano became the official provider of neutral support for Tour de France. And somebody raised the question to me about, well, how would the other teams feel like Campy and SRAM. And I think the purpose of neutral support is way above that. It's not about what the other teams think. Tell my listeners what neutral support actually is.
That's actually a wonderful question. And even some, very astute bike race watchers kind of don't know what those cars are. And it's a really terrific story. It dates back to the early 70s. And it was, really utter chaos in the caravan, that group of vehicles that followed the Pro Peloton around any given race, whether it's small or big. You know, even some local races have this, and there's officials in there, and there's a doctor's car, and there's all these team support cars that have spare bikes and wheels and bottles for their riders. Well, of course, in a proper road race, a breakaway is going to happen, and, one or 10 riders will go up the road, and every time that would happen, those team cars have to pass the peloton to get up to support those riders. On American roads, it's not that difficult. There's usually a wide stretch of road somewhere that'll let that happen. But on those white roads of Europe, those narrow roads, they're already only a car and a half wide. You got a curb-to-curb peloton, and getting by can often be dangerous, and a lot of incidents happen. Imagine you had 10 riders in the breakaway, one from 10 different teams. That's 10 cars that have to go back, and then the brake gets absorbed. They got to come back again. So the then president of Mavic, a guy named Bruno Gourmand, proposed this idea. What if we had just one car who was like Switzerland, completely neutral? He would service any rider for any reason. And in fact, that car can start at the front of the race and drop back to the brake when it was needed. Never have to pass the peloton, never have to pass the group, and then could scuttle ahead to the front if the brake were being absorbed or if the team cars, if there's a big enough gap and the team cars were allowed to come up. So they gave it a run at Paris-Nice in 1973. And it's been a fixture in the peloton ever since. These days, the UCI and most of its affiliated national bodies have it a requirement for certain classes of road racing and up. And so it really was a Mavic innovation. And they, of course, being French and ASO being a French company, had enjoyed a long, long history together. And to be fair, Mavic had always had kind of a sweetheart deal. Back in the day, the money that was changing hands between the organizers and the company was pretty small potatoes considering the size of the exposure that those yellow cars would get. Many companies have been in that business. There's still dozens of companies in there. I mean, we think about the big globally televised races, but you go to a local race in Canada or Italy or Belgium today, and there's these little neutral support companies that are running around supporting races, and they do the hard work, right? They're not there for the TV. They're not on TV. They're just keeping racers moving forward. And, the role of neutral service is really just to make sure that an incident, a mishap, or a puncture doesn't take somebody out of contention, kind of keeps those players in the game. And that Shimano's taken it over. It's the sign of the times, I think, in this world of consolidation. It got very expensive. Of course, you read the news, and Mavic's been on and had some really tough times of late.
Right.
And, Shimano's just getting bigger. So
I have a question about what happens to riders when – let's say they do have a puncture, neutral support comes along, they probably just give them a new wheel or whatever it is. Is it contingent upon the rider to catch back up, or do they have any kind of help? I know they can't be, escorted up, but.
Well, it's a great question. And, especially in larger caravans in Europe, larger pelotons and 200 rider pelotons in the bigger races, puncture will happen. Normally, and most riders would prefer to have their team car get the service because they're going to get on familiar equipment,
right?
And things like that. But if the team car's not around and they get a neutral service, they'll absolutely take it. They're not really supposed to be towed back up. The rules are written that a rider can use the caravan to make his way back to the peloton. You're really not supposed to tow a rider. We know that it's in the best interest of most situations to give a little aid. Most team cars will drop back and tow a rider back up. They'll face a fine if it's too egregious. But really, it's in the interest of let's keep the players in the game. If in the end it's happening very close to the end of a race and it changes the balance or the outcome of a race, you're going to hear a big stink about it. But pretty much all day long, every day in bike racing, riders get towed back on, or the caravan's big enough and long enough that they can hop from car to car and make their way back in.
My other question is about what's on these neutral support cars. So, now people have Shimano, or they have Campagnolo, or they have SRAM, and nothing is cross compatible the way it used to be. I mean, it used to be you could probably throw a 6-speed wheel or a 5-speed wheel back in there and it would work.
So that's so true.
So today, yeah.
It's been a lot more complicated, especially now that even today, even in 2021, we'll see more teams starting with disc brakes, but some teams are still adamant about rim brakes. So not only do you have the drivetrain compatibility, but you have rim brake, rim width. So wider wheels versus narrow wheels. If you pull out a narrow wheel and you try to stick a wide, like a Firecrest wheel in there from Zip or something like that, it'll be difficult. But there is a technical committee that works with UCI and all the Olympic affiliates that has tried to mandate at least some specificity to it all with through axle dimensions and rotor size dimensions. And for the most part, if it's an 11-speed or a 12-speed cassette, they're close enough in their spacing that it'll work. And typically what we're seeing today in the advent of disc brakes, we're seeing a lot more whole bike changes instead of wheel changes just because of through axles and brake compatibility. It's almost as quick to swap a bike off the roof than it is to change a wheel. And often if it comes from neutral service, it's really just long enough until a team car with the proper stuff can show up. So it's kind of a Band-Aid until the team car can make it up to their rider.
How interesting. One more time, let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Chris Zygmunt. We've been talking about what is neutral support and how it works. And it's fascinating. Everybody kind of knows the yellow Mavic team cars. Well, now they're going to be blue and white Shimano cars. Do you think it'll go past the Tour de France? Do you think they're going to be in all the Grand Tours now?
Well, you know, here's the thing, for all that you see on TV, it's a multi-million dollar investment, right? For any Grand Tour, it's a minimum of three cars, two motos, a supply van, big logistics, lots of equipment, and lots of personnel. You know, that's a big nut. Plus just the cost of entry. It's a multi-million dollar opportunity to pay for the privilege, to get your cars on TV. So, I'm sure we'll see other brands step up. Tour of Italy for the Giro had a few years. Vittoria Tire rebranded some old Mavic cars, and Vittoria was the neutral service. I think we're going to see more and more commercial opportunists because, in my opinion, and Shimano is a great company, I just don't think they really need the extra exposure. And it's going to be a point of diminishing return for them. I think the Tour is going to benefit them pretty well. It's a new stage for them. But I think you're going to see other brands, maybe even non-cycling brands. It's not hard to imagine a Coca-Cola car or another global brand that just wants the exposure, that sort of aiding all cyclists, Red Cross sort of feel to it. It's a really positive position.
That's really interesting. I will be on the lookout for that. That's fascinating. So what's next for you? What are you up to these days?
Well, the two big things for me are, one, a little PSA here. I'm just wrapping up a battle with prostate cancer, and so all the male listeners out there, make sure you're getting your PSA checked in your blood work, and all the people who love those men out there, make sure they're doing it because it'll save your life. So
I really appreciate you saying that. I needed to leave that up to you, but
no worries. No, happy to do it. And really, it's one of those things, like a lot of things, if we just take the time to get ourselves checked, you can save some lives. So I'm fortunate I got checked and solved the problem early. But then professionally, a couple things. I'm continuing with my consulting work, but I've just gone about, it really grew out of pandemic need, where it started with some neighbors asking for help because they simply couldn't get service at a bike shop 6 and 8 and 9 weeks out. And they told some friends, and then their neighbors and their friends. So it turned into what was just helping some neighbors out, has blown up into a full-blown cycling studio. And in 2021, this spring, as soon as we can travel a little bit more, we're going to be offering some curated, customized gravel tours around our beautiful state of New Hampshire. So that's what's keeping us busy over here.
Yeah, it sounds like you're going to actually stay home for a change.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
Oh, that's great. Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. If people want to know more about your gravel tours, because, of course, that is the hot ticket, and I don't know how you're going to manage the COVID protocols, but I imagine you're figuring that out, and hopefully people will have vaccines by then, too. How would people find out more about what you're doing?
Well, they're going to find us on the web at altroute.cc. So the name of the company is The Alternate Route, but our web address is altroute@altroute.cc. So
perfect. Well, once again, we've been speaking with Chris Zygmunt. It's been a fascinating conversation. It's so good to catch up with you. And maybe when we get to the East Coast, we'll stop by Alternate Route and say hello.
That'd be wonderful. All the pleasure has been all mine. Thanks so much for having me along. And I look forward to the next time.
Okay. Take care.
All right. Cheers.
Chris Zygmunt joined me from his home in New Hampshire. I really appreciate his willingness to share his journey with us, including his plea to take care of yourself by having your PSA levels checked. It saved his life, and as he said, it could save yours. If you're interested in learning more about Chris's shop, Alternate Route, and his upcoming gravel events, you can log on to altroute.cc. Let's take a short break. And when we return, we'll chat with coach and founder of CTS Training Systems, Chris Carmichael, in the fourth of our January series on training tips. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have BikeLaw as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Let's hear what Chris Carmichael has to say about weekly riding mileage in the last of our four-part series on training. Good morning, Chris. Here we are again. This is our last session for the month of January. And our last question for this four-week period is it better to take one long ride per week or shorter and faster, more intense rides during the week? I think it's a great question. What do you think?
We get this a lot. And, you know, a lot of people go, well, I just don't even know if it's worth it. I can only squeeze in a 50-minute ride or, you know, an hour ride. Is it better I just wait and do a, you know, one big long ride on the weekend? And my answer to that is no, don't do that. What stay away from just doing the big long ride on the weekend and not doing much in between. You know, one of the things we developed was what we call our time crunch cyclist program, and people that, like most of us, we're not professional cyclists, and we have a lot of time constraints with work or family and things like that. And we end up riding 6 to 8 hours a week. And sure, we'd love to ride a lot more, but it's just not available. And so what you want to do is use that time really effectively. And if you don't have a lot of time to get out there, if it's 45 minutes to an hour, you want to make sure that at least a couple of those rides during the week, two of those rides during the week, you're focused on some really good intensity, and intensity being how hard you're riding, because your body adapts to various aspects to cycling. And one of those is the distance or the volume in which you're training. And then the other is the intensity, how hard you're training. And we know that if you're not able to get in those long rides, well, then shift, move away from just doing that on the weekend to increasing the intensity at least twice during your rides that you're doing during the week. And those should either be focused on improving your VO2 max, which are really short, highly intense intervals, 3 minutes or less, or more sustained efforts that give you a little more of that endurance and stamina, which is really focusing on improving your, what we call your lactate threshold or functional threshold. And those are longer intervals, about 10 minutes or so, and not that white hot intensity, but more like, okay, I can keep this up for 10 minutes, this pace up for 10 minutes, and then give yourself a little bit of a rest, and then a little bit of rest, 2 to 5 minutes. And then let's start another one of those 10 minute intervals and maybe do two or three of those during your workout of 50 to 60 minutes on the bike. And you're going to see a marked improvement if you just include twice a week intensity, trying to train and ride at a faster pace or more intense pace than just plodding along, even if you're going out on the weekend and doing a long ride, but you're not doing much in between, adding this intensity is much better than just waiting and doing a long ride and plodding, you know, plodding along on that long ride. And you're not going to get much from that.
So I have a question about mileage and also gearing. Do you have a recommended mileage per week? Or is that like not the goal? I mean, a lot of people, you know, take a lot of pride in riding 2,000, 3,000, 6,000, 10,000 miles a year, which always blows my mind that they have a life and they do all this riding. And then what about gearing when you're doing these intense rides? I know those are two separate questions, but so what?
Well, I guess, first of all, one of the reasons why I think everybody likes to focus on mileage is it's so simple to track, you know, and it looks so cool, you know, when you look at it and go, oh, wow, I did 150 miles this week. And then it's like, now I'm doing 300 miles a week. Mileage is a really poor indicator for training. There's so much else that's going on than just the miles that you're putting in. Let's start moving away from focusing on just mileage, and then let's shift it to focusing on duration, and duration being measured in time. Because, for example, 60 miles of riding on flat terrain is very different and requires very different energy systems than 60 miles of riding in the mountains, right? But, you know, now if you're focused on the duration of the ride and you do 4 hours on flat terrain, you may go 60 miles. 4 hours in the mountains, you may go, you know, 30 miles, depending upon the amount of climbs. Well, you might actually have a more intense, harder ride with shorter mileage in the mountains. So first thing is to shift away from the volume of training measured in mileage, look at it in terms of duration of time. And then we also want to look at intensity to, and we measure intensity in a lot of different ways. The original way is kind of the perceived effort. Oh, that was a really hard ride, or that was somewhat hard, or that was a easy ride. That's sort of the perceived effort of the intensity of the ride. Then it was heart rate. Oh, I rode, you know, average 140s heart rate for the entire ride. Now we've gone to power, and power is the actual measure of the work that you're putting out for the ride, and much better way to measure the intensity of the ride. Because if you're riding and you're averaging, let's say, for 20 minutes, 250 watts for 20 minutes, that's the same amount of work for 20 minutes, whether it's on flat terrain or going uphill, that training load is the same. And so now we've got a really definitive way to establish training intensity. So to simplify it, let's start, you know, it's always great to look at those big numbers and you feel good about yourself. And you can still track it, but let's start shifting the focus to duration measured in time. And then let's also start looking at the intensity of the rides. And let's look at, if you can measure that in power, all the better.
Perfect. Well, Chris, this has just been another great conversation. We've been speaking with Chris Carmichael, Coach Chris from CTS. Once again, CTS, Carmichael Training Systems, is offering listeners of the Outspoken Cyclist a great deal, waiving the sign-up fee for coaching. If you'd like to try a month or 3 months or 6 months or a year, they'll tailor a coaching program to you. You can sign up at trainright.com. And whether you want to get stronger, develop more endurance, or improve your power and fitness, we got top cycling coaches. They'll develop a training program just for you. Chris, this has been wonderful. I hope we can come back and do some more training tips and riding tips. Thanks so much for joining me on the Outspoken Cyclist again today.
Absolutely. Love being here.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Chris Carmichael is the founder and head coach of CTS Training Systems in Colorado Springs, Colorado. If you are ready for some coaching to help develop your skills, improve your endurance, and become stronger, log on to trainright.com. You can use the code OutspokenCyclist at any time to have the sign-up fee waived. So let's take another short break, and when we return, we'll talk about the development of our Cleveland North Shore. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Armin Butish, the Cuyahoga County Executive, had this to say to jumpstart the plans for the new lakefront planning effort. Quote, "To make a huge leap forward for our region, to separate ourselves from our competitors, we must build on our best asset, and that is our lake." Unquote. I could not agree with him more. My guests, Mike Deaver, Mary Serby, and Jim Sonhalter, also couldn't agree more. Hello, Mike, Mary, and Jim. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. It's really going to be fun to talk about our lakefront here in Northeast Ohio. I'd like to start by asking you each to introduce yourselves and what you're doing for the county and what you do in your work. So let's start with Mary. She's the lady of the group.
Morning. Thank you. This is Mary Serby. I am the Executive Director of the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission.
And Mike?
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Mike Dever. I'm the Director of Public Works for Cuyahoga County.
What does that mean, Public Works?
The Director of Public Works. So Cuyahoga County is broken up into 59 communities, and the Public Works Office is really responsible for the county engineer activities in the county. So the county bridges, there's well over 200 county bridges in Cuyahoga County. We're responsible for those. Any of the county facilities, be it the jail, the health and human services buildings, those fall into the public works realm.
Wow.
And then also we provide regional sewer service, not to be mistaken with the regional sewer district. But we provide sewer services to the 59 communities, basically their local sewer lines. So we take care of them for them.
Wow, that's a big job. I hope you have lots of help.
We do. Thanks.
And Jim, you've been on the show before, but reintroduce yourself to the listeners.
I will. Thank you, Diane. I'm Jim Sonhalter, and I'm the Manager of Planning Services for the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission, County Planning for short. And also the project manager for the Lakefront Public Access Plan.
Woohoo! Which is what we're going to talk about today. So let's talk about the Lakefront Access Plan. Who would like to give me some background on it?
Okay, I guess I'll start first. Mike Dever here again. Back in 2019, the county executive, Armin Butish, basically approached myself and our economic development team and asked about, you know, the lakefront in general. He had recently visited a project that was nearing or is in, I don't know, halfway towards completion over in the city of Euclid. What they were doing over there was they identified really a public-private partnership where they were able to gain public access to the lakefront. And when he saw what was going on over there, it's just over a mile long, he in turn came back basically to the department here and challenged us and said, look, why can't we have something like that along the entire 30 plus miles of Cuyahoga County? So with that, it kind of blossomed into a series of discussions with stakeholders and with various governmental agencies, the Port Authority, the sewer district here, the Metro Parks, the Cleveland Metro Park system. And we ended up really brainstorming about thoughts of what could happen along the lakefront. And we decided, why don't we do a deep dive into this and see as the possibility of providing greater access to the lakefront, because it's a true asset here, you know, in Ohio and throughout the region. So fortunate enough, he said, look, I want to make this a priority. We ended up brainstorming, working together, and ultimately where we are today He made an announcement back in late 19 that this was a priority of his. And then in turn, we ended up working with the County Planning Commission to identify a consultant to help us to start a discussion on what could be, how can we improve public access to the lakefront?
I'm so thrilled. And my listeners will be so thrilled. Anybody who lives in Northeast Ohio knows that we spend a lot of time along the towpath and through the Emerald Necklace. But being able to actually ride along the lakefront, walk along the lakefront, get access to it without having to traipse through somebody's yard is going to be really, really nice. Let's talk about implementing this plan. So what's next? If Armin Budish is saying, let's do this, there has to be a plan that needs to be put in place, and that's got to cost money. So both of those things, what's the plan and how is it getting paid for?
Yeah, this is Jim, and I'm a planner. I'm happy to talk about the plan. In engaging Smith Group, we knew that we were going to get a team known internationally for their expertise in active transportation as well as waterfront development. They put together a team of subconsultants to further enhance that. And we're very early on in the process. So in this first phase, we're calling it identifying and analyzing opportunities. So we've reached out to various stakeholders, public agencies around the region, many of them Regional Sewer District, Cleveland Metro Parks, and others, to get their take on it, to find out where they are in their planning, what projects they might have underway, and how a project like this would enhance their missions. We also reached out to other stakeholders. You know, Bike Cleveland is one of them. We're reaching out to the voters associations. We've also reached out to property owners, those most directly impacted by this, by this notion of saying, hey, would you be interested in exchanging private property to allow public access and gain some shoreline protection for your property?
So I have a real quick question before you continue with that. I've had conversations with urban planners such as Jeff Speck and Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, and I know that there's sometimes pushback about bringing, for example, a bicycle path through mm-hmm. residential property, and yet when people do it, there is such a boom in that area economically and just health-wise and happy-wise. And so I'm wondering if you're first getting any pushback yet, or has it gone that far, and what you plan to say when somebody says, well, you know, I bought this land and I don't want to give it up. And
we reached out through the lakefront property owners through a survey that had 11 questions, and the 11th question was the most important and telling question for them. You know, simply, would you be interested in exchanging private property rights to allow public access in exchange for shoreline protection? Yes, no, maybe, I want to learn more. And so far, we've gotten overwhelming interest in that maybe, yes and maybe, in shoreline property owners know the challenges of being right on the lake with record high water levels, more frequent rain events, and just a century long history of inconsistent shoreline protection measures that are often unregulated, unpermitted, unengineered, often just dumping fill into a lake, hoping that it's going to provide some protection. A lot of that is failing, and it hasn't been done throughout the county on a large scale basis. So we're looking to develop projects at scale and not just parcel by parcel, backyard by backyard. We really think that if we can determine areas where there's a lot of interest by shoreline property owners, that's where we can develop a project in partnership with them.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We are speaking with Michael Dever. He is the director of the Cuyahoga County Department of Public Works. Mary Serby is the new executive director of County Planning, and Jim Sonhalter, who is the manager of planning services of the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Mike, Mary, and Jim. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Let's pick up our conversation about the Cuyahoga County Lakefront Public Access Plan. How much of this 30 miles between the west side and the east side, which is the way, of course, Clevelanders think of things, how much of it is owned by landowners? How much of it is public property? And how much of it is maybe not even developmentable, if that's a word, developmentable?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is Mary, obviously. We're doing some detailed analysis on who are the property owners, what are the parcels, how many people, you know, because again, we've got condos that are along the lakeshore too. So there are many owners within that, but it is, you know, maybe just one actual parcel on the lake. But about 90% of it is privately owned. And so what the big takeaway from all of this really is, and Jim mentioned it, it's a partnership. We're not going to go in and go put a bike path through someone's property that is not interested in participating in this. And I also think, you know, there's a vision of what that 30 miles is, and it may look different in different sections of that 30 miles. So an example, you know, that was come up during the public meeting is Lake Road in Lakewood. They recently redid the Lake Road, put in bike path striping on it. So maybe in that section, it doesn't actually touch the lakefront. It's actually a parallel route. And so you see this as an ebb and flow through across those 30 miles and across these communities, and really only going through private property where we have willing property owners.
Got it. So I have a question about the environmental impact of either developing or not developing the land. I know sustainability is a really important thing, and there has been a lot of erosion. The lake is changing. As Jim said, water levels are higher. So what kinds of environmental challenges do you think you're going to run into?
Well, I talked earlier about just sort of the history of shoreline protection and how much of it has been unregulated. So that presents a challenge in itself, how to undo the damage that's happened over time because of that. A really significant challenge in this is simply the topography. We know it's all underlying shale, but in Euclid on the east side, the bluff rises maybe 20 to 25, 30 feet. But as you go west into Rocky River, you've got areas that where the cliffs are 50, 60, up to 100 feet in areas. So in places like that, you know, you're not going to find a lot of beach, for one. You know, you may have areas where you can get to the water. There may be areas where we would look at the public right-of-way as opportunities perhaps for overlooks. You know, just as Mary said, this isn't a continuous trail along the lakefront. It's going to ebb and flow. It's going to weave in and out of neighborhoods and really make strong connections to the Cleveland Metro Parks lakefront reservations, various city parks like Cahoon Park and Lakewood, Bradstreet Landing, Cahoon Park and Bay Village, Bradstreet Landing and Rocky River, Lakewood Park, Gordon Park in Cleveland, Sims Park in Euclid.
Yeah, and I think along with that is just we're looking at this path and how, not necessarily a path, but these connectors and how they work with the north-south connections of existing streets, transit connections. A lot of these parks have transit centers adjacent to them where you can envision someone getting off the bus, unwrapping their bike, and getting on the path and going on their way. So I think it is just this multimodal connector that ebbs and flows through different communities in different ways, and we need the input from the public, from the property owners, in order to make this a successful project.
So I have a question about commuters. You mentioned getting on and off the bus, taking the path, maybe to work, going through maybe Brattonall, wherever you're going. Do you think there'll be economic development along the way and places for commuters to, say, grab a cup of coffee or, you know, in the morning, be able to, you know, get a donut or something like that?
I think there are certainly opportunities to explore that. And, you know, these opportunities do exist in various Metro Parks reservations where there are concession stands, you know, where you could get coffee, and some where there are fishing areas, you can purchase bait. You know, it's so we see this having a lot of potential economic development benefits.
Right. Jim, if I could just add to that also, Mike Dever here again, you know, the towpath trail here in Cuyahoga County, which is well over 100 miles long, is nearing completion now. That was a 40-year effort. But as that project is coming to completion, you can see all of the economic development opportunities that have really grown out of that project in its own. And if you go through the Tremont neighborhood in the near west side of Cleveland, you can see the housing going up. There's small shops that are starting to develop along that line. And it's near completion. Like I said, they've got the final link into Whiskey Island coming in the very near future here. Hopefully by this summer, you'll see the bridge landing into Whiskey Island. So that's an excellent example of what the potential here is along the lakefront.
I know these projects take a long time. Do you have any kind of a timeline from the time you get your survey back and you get some of this information from your consultants, your Smith Group, as to when you'd either have a completion date or have ideas of the sections and how they might begin to fall together?
We anticipate completing the planning phase of this by the end of June this year. Now, once we have a plan, and say we have a project ready to go immediately that we've developed throughout the planning process, it takes 12 to 14 months just to get through the permitting process. It's a lengthy application, an involved application through entities like the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and others, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. But as part of the planning process, as we, you know, say we can focus in on an area, come up with some strong design and engineering recommendations, we would look to engage the Ohio Department of Natural Resources at that time to let them know what's coming, just so that, you know, we're not looking at improvements that take 30 years to complete.
We said in the public meeting, but we're at the starting point of this process. And so it's not something that we're going to all of a sudden see happen. But there are projects that are already happening along this 30 miles. And you did mention some of those in these various communities. And so as you see those, and how do you get connections to then take advantage of those projects that are already happening? And this is a subset of the regional plan. NOAACA's got a plan going on. We can talk a little bit about that. As we get the results of this project, it feeds into that larger transportation project. And so we're very happy to be working with the City of Cleveland, the Metro Parks, NOAACA, all the partners that are looking at the lakefront and how we can improve access to it. It's really an exciting time, I think, to take something that's comprehensive and actually come out with something that we can see be implemented.
Diana, I'd just like to follow up on that. So we are not going to wait for this 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now. We're trying to be proactive today. And some of these on-road improvements that Mary just mentioned, from in Lakewood to Cleveland, Lake Road in Cleveland, to Lakeshore Boulevard over in Euclid, and then also way over in Bay Village, we're doing an improvement on Wolf Road, which is the second parallel route to Lake Road.
Right.
We're doing improvements there also this coming year. So we're moving forward with really those low-hanging fruit parallel routes to the lake, and trying to move those projects forward. Those are all part of the overall Greenway plan too, that I'm not sure if you've touched on in the past. So that's really, you know, trying to get moving on this. We could sit there and perpetually study things forever, but you really got to put a shovel in the ground and get moving on these things. And people are anxious to see things happen.
So here's the elephant that's been hanging in the room that nobody's brought up. How is this project going to get paid for going forward? Uh-oh, silence. Crickets.
Let's use the Euclid project as a model. There is a significant amount of public funding in it to make it happen. And a lot of that comes from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. There's some federal monies involved. And also funds were raised through the establishment of a tax increment financing district that included those lakefront neighborhoods in the project area. So, and this is the area just east of Sims Park and north of Lakeshore Boulevard.
Okay. First of all, there are two things. One is, of course, these projects cost money. But the other thing that I know about building these kinds of things is they create jobs. And so, is there somewhere, we have a new transportation secretary coming online, I hope this week he's confirmed. I mean, this is Friday. It would be nice if they got it together in Washington. But I know that Pete Buttigieg has some really cool ideas. and thinks that he wants to, and these are his words, technologically reinvent transportation. And so I feel like this is part of that. Will there be federal grants available, like the Tiger Grants used to be? Are those the kinds of things that will be available and can be matching?
Mike Dever here. I really see some type of program coming out of the new Biden administration, an infrastructure project or a program. And with that, that's one of the reasons why we really want to continue to move this forward as quickly as possible to take advantage of the possibility. Pete Buttigieg, coming from a Great Lakes state, you know, the mayor over in Indiana there, you know, that's a great benefit to all of us. And so he knows some of the challenges that are here in the Great Lakes. So, yeah, we're positioning ourselves to, you know, what funding may be available. And once again, you know, if a private property owner was to do these type of improvements on their own property, they would not be eligible for this same type of financing, since we're trying to attract public to the lakefront or to provide access for the public. So we really see this as a golden opportunity for both that private individual and then gaining access for the public.
So what's next? What's going to happen between now and it was the end of June that something's going to happen? Is that when the study will be done? Is that what you said, Jim?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. June 2021.
And then what? What's the next thing? And I want my listeners to know how they can get involved if you're looking for public input, which I think you are.
We certainly are. And that's how we're going to make this happen. So I'll answer that section of the question first.
Okay.
You can follow this project on our project webpage, and it's countyplanning.us/lakefront. And we have a video recording of first public meeting that we held just last night. As you can imagine, it prompted a lot of questions from the public. So we're compiling those, kind of grouping them thematically. And we'll be adding those questions and answers to a frequently asked questions and FAQ page for the project. So you're going to find information on plans as they're drafted, as they develop. You're going to find updated information constantly. So it's our goal to keep the public informed every step of the way.
Yeah, and there are still active surveys available for property owners on our website, specifically a separate one for property owners. And then there is a public, we're really looking for input from the public on that. And I think last night we did some kind of in-presentation polling, and the biggest response in the beginning was, would you go there if there were better connections to the lake? And resounding yes, you know, better access, better connections. So we feel like we're getting the word out there. You know, there's Cheers Project is happening. They have a public meeting next week. A lot of these things that are happening, the whole goal of to get through this planning process is to get the public input. Because then once you get the input from the public, you're able to say, yes, we have concurrence on this. We're going to move forward. We're going to apply for this fund. And so it's critically important to get input from the public.
Well, it's a very exciting project for Northeast Ohio, and I think it needs to be a major project. I was very disappointed to see them put yet another stadium on the lakefront instead of developing it right then and there for public access. I will post everything that I've got with this countyplanning.us/lakefront on our social media. And we will keep looking at this. Jim and I will stay in touch. And I really appreciate all the work that you guys are doing. I think that everybody in Northeast Ohio and anybody coming to Cleveland, it's another tourism attraction right along places like the Rock Hall and the Science Center. I just think it's awesome.
We do too.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your excitement.
All right.
Thank you, Dan.
All right.
Thanks,
have a great day, everybody. We'll talk again.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. You know, the Ohio and Erie Canal towpath, which is over 100 miles long, has been a 40-plus year project that will finally see its final connector piece drop into place later this year. The new 30-mile plan will get underway a lot sooner. If you are interested in learning more about the lakefront planning effort, you can log on to countyplanning.us/lakefront. There you'll find surveys, project details, FAQs, and more. My thanks to all my guests this week, and my thanks to you for listening. We'll be back with a brand new show next week, including a review of Molly Herford and Peter Glassford's new book, Becoming a Consummate Athlete. Please remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Won't you rate our podcast on your favorite app and maybe leave a review? We'd appreciate it. Thank you for listening. Only 4 more weeks until March 1st. Spring is right around the corner. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.